I want to welcome everyone to our Keeping on Track open line. We are celebrating over 20 years in business and just entering our seventh year of doing this program. We have a few new exciting changes. First, we have a new 2015 open line format that comes with the launching of our brand new website. If you haven't had a chance to browse around and see our brand new video on there, it's pretty cool. You can also find an archive of past topics on the publication and events tab, and you can go back pretty close to 7 years for all the different topics we've covered. Plus, we have a brand new book, Cracking the Business Code. It's available on Amazon, or you can click on the book icon on our homepage. Our topic today is pre-sale planning. Maximize the market value of your company. My name is Dana Barocca. I'm the CEO of Lighthouse Consulting Services, and we'll be hosting our program today. We have just a few housekeeping items, then we're going to jump right into our topic. For those of you joining us for the first time at Lighthouse, everything we do goes back to our mission statement to bring effective insight to your organization. And we do this through our in-depth work style and personality assessments for helping to raise the hiring bar and help organizations to gain insight of how to get the best out of individuals on a current team. Our Keeping on Track Open Line series is always in response to the calls we get from clients, both domestically and globally, to address the various business issues that organizations are facing today. Our goal is to make this an interactive program, so on your screen, you'll see an area that you can send questions or ideas in during our discussion. We'll attempt to respond to as many as possible, so please join us with your thoughts and insights you have along the way. At the conclusion of our program, we're going to open up the line so you can talk directly with our guests. During the program, you'll want to write down two or three questions, so you can either send them in during the program or you can ask once we open the line up. I want to introduce a very good friend of mine, a past Vistage member. We spent lots of time together at Vistage meetings. So our special guest today is John Murphy, who's president of J.K. Murphy Advisories. For John's entire career, he has helped owners of private businesses set strategic direction, prepare for and facilitate M&A transactions, and accomplish growth acting in an advisory board type role. John was an investment banker for over 20 years and started the strategic advisory practice back in 2004. His experience allows him to provide his clients with the best financial guidance for their strategic growth, liquidity, succession, and shareholder transitional needs. He graduated from the University of Wisconsin with a BBA in finance and marketing and the University of Chicago with an MBA in finance. I feel privileged to have John with us today, and I just can't wait for the ideas that John's going to share. I think you're all going to find them to be very helpful and actionable. Also, registration for our next program will begin at the end of today's program. The topic will be attracting, motivating, and retaining top performers. John, I want to welcome you to Open Line. I think this is the first program you've done with us, and we're very excited to have you with us.
Hey, Dan, thank you.
We actually already have a question that came in, and I want to throw this out before we go to the first slide, because I think it's going to help set the framework and the foundation for our discussion. The question is, there's various types of firms that organizations can engage of when they're preparing their organization for packaging it. And there's different service providers, such as investment bankers, and there's many others. So I thought maybe you could take just a couple minutes and explain what the role of an investment banker is versus others.
Well, first of all, thanks for inviting me. You and I have known each other for a long time, and I can't believe you've been doing this 7 years. That's just awesome what you're providing for people. And thank you for that intro. That was a lot in one breath, so I appreciate you getting through that. So you asked a great question. There's a lot of services, particularly in this professional service world, available to business owners, both before and during a transaction. Just a quick run through. Investment banks are the transactors who sort of are certainly the key point when a company's decided to do either a capital raise or a sale transaction. Accounting firms, generally speaking, people are best off with some kind of outside accounting so that It's not just the company's opinion that the potential buyers and investors are relying on. And there's many, many firms, both investment banks and accounting firms, to choose depending upon your needs. There's due diligence people. There's specialists you can bring in to prepare a company, the nuts and bolts and the due diligence side, both in terms of a website and online, as well as the actual raw data. There's lawyers, starting with M&A lawyer, mergers and acquisitions. My strong recommendation for anybody thinking about selling or raising capital, despite whatever great relationship you might have with your outside general counsel or your inside general counsel, if you don't have somebody with great transaction experience and a lot of great recent transaction experience, I would highly recommend investigating that type of lawyer to add to the team because it's critical. I've seen it both ways. I've seen the divorce lawyer, outside general counsel, et cetera, for someone who has a 25 or 30-year relationship try to be a transactor. And I've seen the same situation where the client rightly hires somebody that's focused just on M&A, and I can assure you that the outcome is better with the latter than the former. Certainly there are other types of lawyers, trusted estates lawyer, making sure that your will and trust and what you want to do with any money you might receive out of a transaction is in good shape. And then once you get into the transaction, there's very very detailed skill set experts like insurance, ERISA, environmental people that can help with particular issues along the way. I'd say, though, that the one thing just to kind of say how we fit into that scheme is we're ex-investment bankers that didn't have any fun anymore in investment banking. I started this business 11 years ago realizing that somebody needed to help pull all this together way before the transaction starts for a client. And generally speaking, the way I think of it is investment banks tend to like, not all of them, but most of them, like companies that don't that know what they want to do, that know what kind of transaction they want and are ready to go. We tend to want to work with companies that aren't sure of what to do. They don't know if they want to grow it, sell it, buy each other out in the case of multiple managers or multiple owners, and aren't really ready to go, because our job is to help them figure out what the right timing is, which we'll talk about today, what the right transaction is, and how to prepare the best themselves for something like that. So that's actually a good segue into the slides. Thank you for that question, whoever asked.
Perfect. Thank you, John.
On page one, I thought it would be helpful to just give you an idea of sort of what we typically find, what's happening in the companies that we're working with, and why, I guess, in some cases they hire us. The big phrase that I use is generally our clients, either they know what they want to do, they want to sell 2 or 3 years down the road and want to get ready, or they're not sure and they're sort of stuck. They're stuck because the growth plan in their head isn't working as well in practice. They're stuck because they realize that their current shareholders, fellow shareholders, sort of have a different opinion about where they want to go and what they want to do with the business. And they can't keep or hire talented managers, because if there's anything that I share with you today, the one single value driver that I've found proves time and time again to be worth the money, worth its weight in gold, and that is I find more value created with the more smart people in the company, the more value I find created. And sometimes business owners can't wrap their head around how to get there or how to keep people that they've gotten involved in the company. So those are all kind of reasons why, from a 30,000-foot level, that people might engage us. Turning to page two, now kind of getting a little further into the weeds, or check under the hood, as we like to say it. What we tend to find in our clients, for whatever reason that they brought us in, either to get us ready, get them ready for sale because they know that that's what they want to do, or they're not sure what they want to do, or the three biggest areas that we work on are pre-sale planning, which is the largest, and then some want to grow for a while and then sell, so sort of accelerated growth planning. And the third is not quite sure what to do, which we'll talk about, called strategic direction. So these are things that we typically find. Inconsistent operating performance, way too much emphasis on revenue and not profitability. We find a lot of times people don't say no. They don't say no to a new growth initiatives or a customer. The analogy we like to use, Dana, is that growth is like a garden. So imagine yourself sitting in your back, and you're standing in your backyard with a bunch of grass seeds, throwing them out of the yards, and you plant thousands of seeds when you sit there and throw them. And the reason you do that is because it's cheap and easy. And similarly in growth, we find that a lot of business owners try to pursue many growth initiatives because initially it might be inexpensive to do that. The problem is that you can't nurture all those seeds. And so you end up with a garden that doesn't look very good. It's kind of sparsely populated, and most of the plants aren't growing very well because you weren't able to nurture all of them. Our perspective is it's better to plant fewer seeds and focus. And oftentimes the key to planting fewer seeds is just establishing up front what the right criteria is to judge amongst the seeds. How much risk do I want to take? What's the potential return? Does it fit with our core competencies, et cetera? Sort of establish the five or six criteria that you want to use in order to decide amongst all those growth initiatives so you don't try to fund them all and end up with a not so good looking garden. On page three, the other things that we tend to find.
That's a really great analogy.
Well, it's just, thank you. It came to us in the sense that we see it all the time that the three key mistakes that we find business owners make are they don't hire or keep enough good people, they don't focus, and they don't have good books and records. And when I say good books and records, I mean having data to manage the business dependable and timely for you to be able to manage the business. Because when you go to sell the business, you got to have the numbers in order to for a sale process, but you know, flying blind is not a great alternative. And so, and the fourth is, of course, growth, spending too much money on growth. So that growth one is where we often spend a lot of time because it's where business owners spend money they shouldn't and spend money that they could otherwise either have for themselves or invest in other things because they spend on too many options. So thanks, I appreciate that. The other things we find on page three are, again, management teams. Not only the people, but how you manage them and how you let them manage. We often find that they make subpar decisions, either because business owners don't let them or they're not capable of making decisions because business owners aren't hiring smart enough people to be kind of fit into the system sort of thing. And there's very little we find in the way of the future. What's the plan? Where are we going? What's the forecast? How do we get there? How are we forecasting? One of the things we'll talk about later is in value drivers that companies that can predict where they're going better than others will get a higher premium. So the more visibility you have on earnings and revenue, generally speaking, the higher you get for your business. So that's an important practice, but practice and practice and practice, the better you're going to be, especially if you're in our sales process.
Hey, John, you brought up a good point. One of our clients, they just sold their business. And probably 6 months to a year prior to sale, the accounting department did an amazing job of preparing the books for the selling process. But one of the things they did was they brought an outside auditing firm in as if it was another organization auditing them. And they wanted to see what that would look like. Well, when they did put it up for bid and organizations came in and they showed them these books, the organization thought, wow, because they hadn't seen that before, and which actually raised the price of the organization because it was so clean and forthright. There was no mystery.
So that's all about planning and preparation. That's probably what's called a quality of earnings, which is a relatively new phenomenon in the accounting world in the deal world in about the last 10 years or so. What that does is it takes whatever existing documentation and numbers the company has, particularly from an outside firm, and just focuses on cash flow because, as we'll talk in a second, most of value is driven from how much cash flow you have in your business. And this is an accelerated or even more detailed way to get at just the cash flow. We've hired about 6 or 7 accounting firms to perform quality of earnings for sellers in the last 2 years because it's so important and to sort of know where you stand exactly on that important issue, and so you know how to play all the other issues along the way because you know what they're going to find when they get there. And the reason you do that is because no buyer buys these days without ordering a quality of earnings on the seller as you get further down the process. So that was a great thing for your company to do, Dana, to make sure that they knew they were well prepared.
Yeah.
Moving to page four, this is something we call strategic direction, and it's probably one of the more important parts of of anything that we can share with you today. These are the key drivers of helping build a plan for where our clients want to go. Now, some of them, as I say, come to us saying we want to sell, or they come to us with not quite sure what they want to do. And so these are the 7 kind of ingredients, if you will, that we use to cook up a plan, and the recipe is trying to figure out what's the best thing to do. The top 3 are you personally as business owners, and the bottom 4 relate to the business. So starting in the upper left, one of the most important things is future risk. How much risk do you want to take in your life? And in fact, when we're bought into companies where there's multiple shareholders, and interestingly enough, 80% of our clients have multiple shareholders, there's usually always a small issue or a big issue going on. If somebody's got their foot on the gas and somebody's got their foot on the brake, and we're bought in to help resolve that as part of the work we do, and usually that's totally a function of risk. Some owners want to take a certain amount of risk and some don't. And so that's a key thing in driving, agreeing on a plan for where we should drive the business. The other things are personal financial goals. So you all may work with wealth advisors in the world, of which there are many talented ones, and they should be helping you with trying to estimate how much money do you need for the rest of your life, depending upon, regardless of where you are in your life. And if you're not working with someone that can do that work for you, you should find someone that does, because the better ones all offer it for free as part of their work to say, if I make so much money now, how much am I going to spend over the rest of my life? How much money do I need to fund that, et cetera, and other. So those personal financial goals are really important to driving time as well as, you know, what my options are. And then personal and professional goals. Last year we worked with a business owner whose personal goal that drove all the timing related to our pre-sale planning process was he wanted to sell his business by 30. That was the single goal that we worked, that was the most important goal, there were other goals, that was the most important goal that we worked under for that client. I'm working right now with another client that who's in the market selling his business, whose primary goal was he saw his father work till 74 and die 6 months after he retired, and he wasn't going to let that happen to him. His number one goal was to sell the business in his late 50s so that he could enjoy the rest of his life. So those personal and financial goals are really important. Those personal elements, all three, the financial goals, the risk appetite, and the personal goals, they're very important in driving the business, driving the solution or the option that you all pick for your business, because it's you. And the good news on those three is you can't make a bad decision, because it's your feelings and it's your goals and it's the way that you want to look. The bottom four are a little different. They're related to the business. They are, you know, some companies look good at certain times and not so good at other times. So again, timing, as you see at the bottom, is critical to all these. But let's kind of go through it from the bottom, from the middle left across to the right. So what's the real opportunity for growth? We call it a growth story that the company has. What's the real opportunity for growth that the company has? Now, there are many opportunities for growth, but getting to my point later, what's the best and real opportunities? So trying to understand that as part of our discovery is what we do. And what are the required resources for that growth, for the optimal growth? How much capital does it need? How many good people? How many facilities in case you're making something? How much capacity in the case of an internet business? So what are the resources that you need to achieve that growth story? What are the conditions today or whenever you're considering this for capital? Today in the private markets for capital, there's so much capital that you guys probably get phone calls all the time from private equity groups and other capital sources that have gotten, they think, smart in the last 10 years by doing reaching out and doing one-off initiation programs. I'm sure you've all gotten calls from them, and I'm sure they've increased in the last few years because they're all trying to get a proprietary deal, what they call a proprietary deal, which is there's no investment bank involved. And the reason, of course, is they think they get a better deal if there's no investment bank involved, and I'm sure they do. But what are the general conditions for capital? Today, the general conditions for capital are very strong. It's a seller's market in almost every way that I've seen. And it's hotter than it was in 2007 before the Great Recession, and I've been doing this stuff for over 30 years, and I would guess that it's as hot as I've ever seen it. And then what are the realistic strategic options? So just because you can go public doesn't mean you should, and many companies can't go public as an example. That's a strategic option. But trying to understand, can you really go public? Is that really a legitimate option? And while that may or may not fit for most of you, the more direct one is sometimes we're introduced to a company that it's a lifestyle. It's not even a business. And so we say to them, we don't think there's a real buyer for this business because you really don't have a core continuing business here. It's more sort of a collection of things that's a lifestyle. And then, of course, if they do want to get to sell it, we need to engage in a process to make it more of a business as opposed to just a lifestyle. So our thesis is if we can understand these seven ingredients about you and your company, we can help you put a plan together to A, maximize the value, and B, drive the best direction that you want to take for your business and for you personally.
John, we have three questions that came in.
Okay.
So the first question is, let me see if I can boil this down. It seems that in today's marketplace that going public is not a hot place to be these days, but staying private is venture capitalists. Is that true?
Yeah, what's happened is you see all these – well, first of all, the market – there's always a certain sort of running set of criteria that you have to qualify for in order to be public. And those change as market conditions change. And what's happened today is you need to be big. You know, 20 years ago when I moved to California from the Midwest, people were doing 15 and 20 and $30 million IPOs for companies that were having value of 50 to 75 million. I mean, that's just totally gone today. You have to have size. And what's happening in the internet-related businesses, like an Uber is raising private capital, and their valuation is now 30 or 40 or 50, I forget what the last one was, billion dollars. In another era, they might have gone public with a market cap of 500 million or a billion, and public investors would have gotten that money. But now it's the private investors that are making money, although none of them have gotten liquid yet. But they're making money because they keep raising money in the private market because they're getting so good valuations. So the whole dynamic of the public market has really changed in the last 5 to 10 years. And it's totally situation specific now. It's actually been pretty fascinating.
And most of the listeners today are people attending or more in the mid-cap market, I'd say.
Okay.
Privately held. And I've heard this too, that it's just a very hot market for investors on the private side.
It's the hottest market I've ever seen for any form of capital. The one thing, though, is a little – in 2007, which was right before the Great Recession. Excuse my French, but you'd throw any piece of shit against the wall and it would stick and it would get a good deal. Now it's not any piece of it has to be a well-thought-out business plan. But the reality is for any well-thought-out business, the multiples just get bid way up. In fact, on this situation that I'm working with where we're in the market now, I'd say a dozen sponsors have turned it down because they know the business is going to go for such a high multiple because they know they have their shit together, excuse my French, that they're not even going to bid on it because they think that there's no way that they can – their particular philosophy and niche in the world is to not pay a premium price for a premium company, so they're not even bidding. So it's as hot as I've seen it ever. It's totally a seller's market.
That's good. That's good. I know we're going to talk about multiples later on. There are two more quick questions.
Sure.
This is from our friend Gary Sanger. Thank you, Gary.
Hi, Gary.
Please describe ideal timelines for bringing in experts to prepare a company for sale.
Well, all of us will say that earlier the better because there's more time to get our work done. And in our case, it's particularly true because what we're doing is we're trying to identify the warts to fix and identify the value drivers to do more of to create a more valuable story, i.e. company, for our clients. So the more time that we have to identify them, but really the more time we have to fix them and see that pan out, the better off you are. So, you know, we like to be involved a year or two ahead of where we're doing something. You know, 6 months is okay, but not as great as a year. It's kind of like size, Gary. Size in this market matters. So people, when you talk to private equity groups, the first thing you hear from them is, we invest in companies that are $5 million in EBITDA. They put a size parameter on it right away, and they sometimes put an industry parameter on it. So size matters, and in this world of capital from the private equity world, $5 million is better than $2 million, $10 million is better than $5 million, $20 million is better than $10 million. And I would say the same thing here with respect to timing is a year is better than 6 months, and 2 years better than a year, because it's all about the time that we have to fix what warts there might be to make it a more valuable business. And then what we tend to do in our business is there's a real human capital. We're the big picture guys, but we're bringing in skill set experts as we need along the way. So, for example, Dan, as you know, we brought you into a client of ours that's involved in hiring. We brought in compensation experts, one of which you know, Dana. We brought in lawyers. We brought in certainly investment banks for the right time. We've created a process for how to hire the best investment bank. And I think we included some slides on that. We have a for-profit school that is part of the growth strategy that we helped them devise. We decided that we should create a scholarship program for funded by the constituencies of the people that leave this school, which, by the way, has a 99% hiring rate, which is unheard of in their space. And we sought out help for people that set up charities, a not-for-profit, that's not a charity, but a not-for-profit that is funds scholarships for students in this space. So we're always bringing somebody with us. We just never know who till we get there to make sure that, you know, based on what we find the needs are, we'll bring in other service professionals.
Okay. That's great. Well, let's go to the next slide because I want to make sure we cover everything.
Okay.
Great information here.
So generally speaking, here's some options. These are kind of just general ones without knowing any specifics about any of you. You can sell control to a buyer or private equity group. You can sell a minority stake to a private equity group for growth or liquidity. You can do recaps. You can do dividend recaps, which is all shareholders getting some money from cash that you have on the balance sheet or raising cash from the outside. You can do a recap where some shareholders buy out others. If the idea that if this foot on the gas and foot on the brake can't be resolved, then maybe the way to resolve it is to buy those out that either don't want to keep going and want to take the risk spectrum off, so to speak. And there's a variety of ways you can fund that. Or our clients sometimes, you know, just grow without any transaction in mind. We help them build either the vision or the foundation for that. So those are kind of the general options. For those of you who don't know private equity groups, they're a pretty big force in this world. Generally speaking, there's always exceptions to every rule, but generally they buy 60 to 80% of the company because they want management and you as owners to participate and have skin in the game for the next growth initiative, which is funded by them. So they tend to buy 60 to 80%, generally speaking, because they want you and the management team to have skin in the game. And then you get what everybody refers to as the second bite of the apple 3 to 5 years from now when they sell the business. We've had situations where our clients made more money at the second bite of the apple because there was more capital and more risk taken in that second bite at the apple than you or our clients were willing to take on their own. And then strategic buyers, and we've had situations where, you know, they hire our client as CEO, they buy control of the business, and they fire the CEO in a year. So you never know what's going to happen in that circumstance, and you have to make sure that you're trying to deal with the right people at the right time based on what your goals and objectives are in a transaction. Strategic buyers tend to want to buy 100%. They seem to be more willing these days to do something less than 100% if they feel that they have to in order to get a deal. But generally speaking, those are kind of the key starting points for strategic. And, of course, there's variations on the theme of those as well.
A quick question just came in. Is there, for privately held organizations, is there an ideal corporate setup versus maybe doing LLC transfers?
Well, I talk to a lot of lawyers who are both friends of mine and people we work with, and most of my lawyer friends tell me LLCs are the best because they give you the most flexibility. As to how many LLCs you have in terms of drives the structure, my bias is we try not to have bias, Dana, because we never know what we're going to find. We try to be open to everything. But I do have a bias in this, and keep it simple. If it violates the one box rule and you got a chart with all these different boxes and arrows and charts and showing all the corporate structure of a company, to me that's just going to be an impediment when you want to do a transaction. What for whatever reason you set it up, it's certainly legitimate for why you set it up. But what happens in a transaction is your goals change. Your goal is now to sell the business for the most amount of money and whatever other terms that you want to get out of a transaction, whereas you might have set it up for other reasons along the way. So you sort of have to re-examine some of that stuff as part of our checking under the hood to make sure that you're set up now, both big picture and little picture, to maximize the impact of a sale. So I hope that helps.
No, that's another question. Is there a particular lead time, an example? So the question is, if someone has, let's say, a subchapter S and they want to go to an LLC, is there a lead time of 1, 2, 3, 5, 10 years?
Yeah. I know there's a lead time going from a C to an S corp of 10 years, that from the time you convert from a C to an S, if you sell within 10 years, you'll be taxed. You'll get some of it tax protected, but some of it, that's the value that you, at the time that you converted, will be taxed as a C corp. And then after 10 years, it won't be. I'm not familiar with the going from the C to the S to the LLC, other than I know that in my own case, our company is an S corp, and as soon as I changed to an S corp from a C, I realized that the LLC was a much better, more flexible way, and I was told I have to wait 5 years to convert from an S to an LLC, and I think I'm into year four now. So,
okay, thank you.
Sure. On page six, we've been talking a lot about value, so I thought that we should at least talk generally about what is market value and sort of how do we create it. Hey, Dana, I'm changing the slides. Are you changing the slides? Or if I change the slides, does it change for everybody? How does that work?
It changes for everybody.
Yep. Oh, okay, great. So here's the general formula. Now, there's lots of, exceptions to every rule, but just here's the general formula. Cash flow is defined by EBITDA, interest before taxes and depreciation, plus add backs, all the stuff that the private business owners do that public companies don't, times a multiple equals enterprise value, sort of total value. Then you pay back debt, you take cash. So this is a market where most companies trade off of a debtless, cashless value structure. You pay back whatever long-term debt, not accounts payable, but money borrowed with an interest rate that's long-term, and you argue about what that number is. You take out the cash, and that equals equity value. That's the value to shareholders. And then, of course, you pay taxes and transaction expenses off of that. But that's kind of the general format. Now, so there are some industries that don't go off of cash flow. They go off to some volume metric. It used to be in the specialty pharma business. If you sell drugs to institutions, you used to be able to sell off of per beds. But most businesses have either solely focused on cash flow for valuation or predominantly focused on cash flow for valuation. So let's talk about private company add backs for a second. There are things like excess owner's comp, family, non-essential family on the payroll, people that, expense everything rather than capitalize because they want to pay less taxes. There's other tax strategies that business owners use to pay less taxes that aren't the best for when you want to market the company. So we go in and take a look at all that and make recommendations for how much of that we can add back and what things we need to do to improve or sort of solidify and build a foundation around what we want to add back. Then times a multiple, people often say, well, what is my multiple? And the answer is it depends. It depends on how strong is your industry, what are the growth rates in your industry, so staying in tune of that is helpful. How am I compared to people in the industry that represent those growth rates? Do I have better margins? Am I growing faster? Do I have less debt, so I have more equity value? Do I have more better future prospects? Those are all things that, so there's specific company inputs, and then there's industry inputs, and we're going to talk about a number of those in a few pages just ahead. But that's kind of just a general framework for debtless, cashless companies that start with market equity value and get down to start with market enterprise value and get down to market equity value after you pay off the debt and take the cash out. Page 7. So how do you increase your market value? What are the things that we can help you work on or that you can work on yourself in thinking through what to do? So let me just go back to the page. So you can see here that anything you do to increase cash flow or increase your multiple will increase your value. So let's talk about that now. So how do you increase your multiple? Well, less risk. Less risk is that you have signed contracts with customers if that's possible. Less risk is that you reduce the company's dependence on you. If you cast a wide shadow across your company and you haven't invested in a management team, that's going to be a big value detriment when you try to sell your business, most likely. How else do you reduce risk? You reduce risk by having limited concentrations of revenue or limited concentrations of suppliers, because it's harder to get financing for companies that have big concentrations of revenue. So I've mentioned before, I can't say enough, I find a lot of value created with smart people. So the more smart people, if you can figure out a way to get a lot of smart people working with you and keep them motivated at your company, you're going to create more value. We talked about this a little earlier. So here's the next one is, so there's company-specific factors. Now here's an industry one. How fast is your industry growing? How attractive is your industry? Do you get great margins in your industry? There are businesses like distribution businesses, which generally are characterized as having low gross and operating margins. And there are businesses like branded consumer products and even above that, software businesses that have very strong gross and EBITDA operating margins. So those are all factors that include how do you increase your market value. And of course, size matters. Size and market share. One of the first things we try to do with our checking under the hood is try to back into what's our market share. How big is our market? How fast is it growing? And what is our market share? Because everybody wants to be with a winner, and a winner is somebody who's gaining market share. If the market's growing 5, we're growing 10 or 15 or 8. It's something better than that. If the market's growing 2, we're growing 6, et cetera. Companies that have great expanding market share are going to get more value when they either raise capital or sell. On the next page, just continuing on the
John, a question just came in. Where did you come up with this list?
This list is the 30-plus years of experience that David and I, my partner, have with hanging around buyers. You know, our motto is that we think like a buyer, not an owner. And what that means to us is we don't have your emotion. Thank God you had your emotion or we wouldn't be here because your passion built helped build a business. We're not in your forest, which allows us to see things around the next tree, that the old adage is so true. We've looked at thousands of companies in our career. We've been in thousands of meetings with investors as part of selling businesses and raising capital. And these are the lessons learned, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, of what we've been able to glean from all that effort over the last 30-plus years is these are the things that matter to buyers.
Another question just came in. This person has an $18 million business. They're saying they run their business like a mom-and-pop shop. In other words, very dependent on the family members. Do they still have an opportunity to sell it if they didn't bring in hired guns?
Sure. Usually you can sell any business for any price. The question is what price you're going to get. And what we're outlining here today is how to increase the price and potentially maximize the price so that you get the best bang for the buck. But you don't have to do any of these things. You're just not going to get as good a price. And in some cases, you may not get a price. So what I said earlier is in 2007, everything got a price. Not everything gets a price today. What happens today is the really good companies get all the attention, and the companies that aren't well-prepared or well-positioned, they get some attention. Whether they get enough or not remains to be seen. And one of those things that dictates is size. You know, when you're less than $5 million in EBITDA, you really got to work around the edges to try to improve the valuation. It's just the way the world is. It's not right or wrong. But it's getting better. There's more financing below $5 million of EBITDA. But, you know, size does matter, unfortunately, in this market.
Okay, thank you.
Going to page 8, just to kind of continuing on the thing. So how do you get more market value? Have lots of recurring revenue. Let's figure out a way to create recurring revenue in your business model if it's not there, or let's increase it if it's there in some degree. I mentioned earlier this concentration. There's no better buzzkill in selling your business than a big revenue concentration. And I would define big as above 25 or 30%. Now, having said that, there's a way around it. So the last deal I worked on as an investment banker 12 years ago, our client had a 90% concentration with Home Depot. Well, that's pretty big. It's the biggest I ever worked with. But what we did is we built a story around it. The first part of the story was the aisle selection and the market sales of this particular product at Home Depot was 10 times the size at Lowe's. So if you're going to pick somebody, you pick Home Depot because they sold 10 times as much of this product as Lowe's did. Secondly, we calculated this was a product that you had to make. It was a manufacturing business, that it would take somebody 10 years to build the installed base that our company already had to provide this particular product. So then you have to ask yourselves, why would somebody go through the effort for 10 years to build it and then have to compete on price when you're raising capital and putting the cost in today's dollars of a new facility in? Why would anybody do that with any degree of rational economic return expectation? So you can build a story around concentrations, but the less concentration you have, the better. I had a client where he had 100% concentration. He was a supplier. He was a B2B business, and he fed somebody all the stuff they needed to look great in the world, and let me tell you, they looked great. But he had 100% concentration, and he wanted to think about selling his business. And so I said, well, you could easily work with this company's big competitors, because there's lots of them, and I know their names. It's a consumer product. He was making ingredients material for consumer products. And he said, but I'd have to take lower margins from them, and I'd have to deal with them, and I really like only dealing with one company. And I said, okay, well, just know that when you get to the point where you ever mark to market your company, you're going to get hit for that. And he did. He did sell his business, but not for as much as he could have had he changed that concentration. He just decided it wasn't important enough to him to work it into the system and have to deal with four or five customers as opposed to one. That's just his trade-off. But it does impact. And then we talked a little bit about good visibility on revenue and EBITDA. So, more visibility, the better off you are, because the more underwritable you are, the more sustainable at the bottom you see, that's recurring. So private equity groups, they love leverage because it's part of how they get the equity returns that they're looking for. And so the more sustainable and the more repeatable and the more underwritable your cash flow is, the better off the more leverage you're going to get, which means the higher price private equity groups can play. And part of that is how much visibility you have in revenue. So that actually ties with the recurring revenue. So if you can create a business model that has more recurring revenue, you're going to, by definition, you're going to create more visibility on the expectations of your return. Scalable. So scalable is an important thing if a growth story. Scalable to me means how much operating leverage is in the business. Can your margins grow as you grow? Because you're amortizing your fixed and infrastructure costs over greater revenue. So some business models, as companies grow, it eats into margin, and some businesses, as they grow, it enhances margins. Well, obviously, you're going to get more money if it's an enhanced margin business model. And there are ways that you can think about how to change and refine your business model to create that. Lastly, on page 9, just a couple of general thoughts. Again, anything you can do to increase revenue or EBITDA or decrease risk will increase value. One of the things that we've seen as a big market indicator is we're getting a lot of business from companies that have been contacted by buyers, both strategic and private equity. The owner doesn't know they don't know what they want to do, and they aren't ready to go, even if they want to have a conversation. So part of the value of the work that we do, with a shameless plug here, is that we make you ready to go, whether you have an intention to sell or not. So it's not a perfect analogy, but you know, having your house look great in case you ever want to sell it, as opposed to having, you know, to do all that pre-work, that prep work, when in fact somebody says, hey, are you thinking of selling your house? And then finally, run the company, regardless of whether you want to sell or not, or whether you have intention, always run the company as if you're not selling. Always make that investment that you would. If you're engaged in a process or thinking about being engaged and you have a decision to make, I would say, ask yourself, if I wasn't thinking of selling, what decision would I make? We had a company that was a regional-based business, manufacturing business, and they went into a new region and then decided to sell. Well, naturally, they didn't look as good right at that moment because they had made this investment in this new market but hadn't seen the return. So we argued in the process that we should get the benefit of that because the buyer is going to get the benefit of owning this new regional asset forever when the company didn't exactly look as good as it could have been because it wasn't getting the return back. But run the company, and we were able to get paid for it. So run the company as if you're not selling, which actually is an interesting lead into this page, which is timing. So the transaction, what are the things to consider? We put a few down here. But I think the general phrase that I think of in this page is you get the best deal when you look the best. So try to understand what is looking the best mean in your case, great growth, great margins, great future growth prospects, and think of it as driving. If by the time you end up selling to somebody, they're going to know everything that you know about your company. So if you milk it dry, they're going to figure it out, and they're going to price it accordingly. If the best time to sell is when you allow, not all the growth is in the rear of your mirror. If you milk it and all the growth is in the rear of your mirror, and the average reasonable business person is going to project that there's nothing coming out the front windscreen of the car, you're going to get the price accordingly. You're probably not going to fool somebody, because all these guys have been through the ringer enough. I mean, think about it. When you go to sell your business or raise capital, you're dealing with, in the private equity world, professional buyers. That's all they do is buy businesses. In the case of strategic, the corporate development group, that's all they do is buy businesses. You're a one-time seller, and they're a professional buyer. So you're not going to pull the wool over their eyes. And it might happen maybe once in a while, but generally speaking, it's not. So trying to get your ducks in a row on the one hand and making sure that you look the best you can is part of what our sort of thesis is. And you can see here there's a number of questions that we ask as part of the process of saying, what's the right timing for something? On page 11, this is just our process real quickly. So to do our work, we need to get immersed in the company. So we meet with owners, all the old shareholders. We meet with the management team. We understand how good they are, what their contribution, what their opportunities for growth that they see are. We attend management meetings to understand the culture and rhythm of the company. We, of course, immerse ourselves in the industry research. If we're not experts, and by the way, we're not experts in any business, that in the industry that we work in, we say that you, our client, are experts in your industry. We know the world of capital, so we make a good team that you've decided to raise capital or sell in the case of those for pre-transaction planning. We try to understand where we can create new recurring revenue or new revenue streams and make sure that the company is right-sized on a margin perspective. And then we take the management team and run them through a series of four to five meetings to create the plan, the numbers. This world works on numbers. In order to go to this world, you have to have a good numbers in the past, and you have to have good well thought out numbers for where you're going in the future. This world likes the context, but it works on numbers. So what we do is help create our clients for a we create the best plan that we can. And in that process, we help them vet through and poke holes in all the different strategies for growth to arrive at the best one for growth. And then, of course, we implement it and maintain it and monitor it on a regular basis, and if necessary, help them pick a transaction team. So how to hire the best team? So the best thing about this two pages, sorry, I jumped ahead. The best thing is that when you're going to hire an investment bank, when you're going to hire an accounting firm, but mostly investment banks at this stage, is they're going to give you all their best ideas for free. You just got to talk to them. I think the biggest mistake that a lot of companies make is they get introduced to an investment bank by their lawyer or whoever they find, and they only talk to one person. I just had it recently happen to me, a company that I met at a presentation that we made, and the week before they had just hired an investment bank, and they said, well, our lawyer introduced us to it, and they sell a lot of companies in our business, and so we hired him. I said, well, what value did they think that you're going to sell for and why? And they said, well, we haven't gotten that far. And I said, you hired them, and you don't even know what the expectation is for them or the expectation for you? So strongly suggest, if you're going to get to this stage, conduct the process of talking to a few people, maybe more than a few depending on your circumstances. They will give you free information. You just got to ask them the questions. And then what we do is this is the process we created. It's the recipe. We cook it, if you will, every time. But we get a lot of information out of all the investment banks that we talk to for our clients. And then we distill it, and we take all their best ideas and put it into the program for the bank that we hire, all the best buyers. Every investment bank has different buyers. They have probably 60 to 70% the same buyers, but that 30% can yield great buyers that one person thought of that others didn't, and the same is true for everybody you talk to. And what we typically do is introduce our clients to five or six banks. We never know who they're going to connect with the most. We never know who's going to be the interested the most. We try to connect them with industry experts, big banks, small banks, banks in LA where we're based, banks not in LA, generalist firms. We want to get different voices that they hear, so because we never know who's going to have the best idea, and we never know who they're going to connect with the most. When we limit it to two or three, we give them the information about where we're going and where we've been, and then we have full-blown presentations. But just the best advice I can give on these two pages is don't talk to just one person. They will give you tons of information for free because they all want to get the deal. They all want to impress us to make sure that we're the best ones, and all you got to do is ask them. And, of course, other key players, we talked a little bit about this earlier, accounting. Having a great accounting firm, whether you're going to sell or not, is always a good idea. Some of you may feel like it's insurance and above and beyond the call of duty, but I think it's just necessary. Having great numbers and having another interested set of eyes and ears poking at your numbers can only result in good things as far as I'm concerned. But you need a good accounting, trust and estate, tax, and wealth management as if you're going to sell as part of a real team of people. To try to get the best result. But the one thing that I say to my clients about investment banks is they're going to have hundreds of conversations with you without you on the phone about your baby. So who do you trust the most? Who represents you the best in terms of style, capability, and experience as to letting people know what you think the important things of your business are? All right. Marketplace trends. We talked a little bit about this already, but it's as hot as I've ever seen it, and I've been hanging around this place for a while. We've gotten a lot of business from unsolicited inquiries. We're business owners, again, going back to we're interested in companies who don't know what they want to do and aren't ready to go. And when you get a call that seems interesting, that's what we can help our clients do, is helping them figure out what to do and the and get ready. In some cases, you know, what we recommend is all different. In some cases, we've hired investment banks based on that conversation because we tell our clients, this is an interesting conversation, and they agree. It's always hard to know where you stand with one conversation, so let's widen it. And the best way to widen it is to have an investment bank talk to more than one person. So in some cases, we've turned down based on the circumstances and said no. In some cases, we've said yes, we'd like to have it. A loan, I've got two where we had a loan. In the 11 years that I've been doing the strategic advisory work, there's only twice that we've not recommended. Well, once we recommended, he said no. The other one, we didn't recommend hiring a banker because the price was extraordinary. But every other time, there's value with investment banks. And then some we say no and create the value ourselves. Some we say yes, and we'll have a conversation in two cases. And some we say yes, we'll have a conversation, and we widen it with investment banks. So the answer is always different depending upon the circumstances. But I foresee that you will continue to get calls. You'll continue to get more calls. It's one thing getting a call from a guy in a boiler shop where they hired a young voice just out of college with a bachelor's degree to dial for dollars. It's another thing. Recently I had a client get a two-page letter. Who sends letters anymore? But they sent a letter describing why they were interested in purchasing my client and to a business they already bought, which is in their line called an add-on, where they make an infrastructure investment in a company. Well, that's another thing. If you can be looked at as an infrastructure, the starting point of a thesis of a buildup for a private equity group who are likely going to invest more capital and make a company bigger through acquisitions, you'll get a better multiple because having the right infrastructure, that's a management team, that's a great computer system, that's mostly a management team. Having a full build-out management team, you have the potential to be a platform rather than an add-on. But having a well-thought-out inquiry from a potential buyer, like this two-page letter example, is a far different conversation that you might want to have than having some 24-year-old kid out of school calling, wet behind the ears, calling and dialing for dollars. And the private equity groups that employ that kind of strategy for trying to get your interest, to me, is somebody that I would not want to talk to. I would much rather have my client spend time talking to the firm that thought enough of me and the client to write a two-page thesis on why this makes sense and why they would want to have a conversation. And then we also talked about the economy. It's as strong as we've ever seen it. Certainly, that's the case. And like I said, I think something's going to knock it off its perch, but I have no idea when and I have no idea what.
Murph, one last question. Gary Sanger posed, what is your sweet spot for industry? You summarized it in the last slide, but if you boil it down.
Our industry, Gary, we have no industry. We work with companies all across the spectrum, a financial services company, a healthcare services IT company, an internet-based consumer products company, a healthcare business, Gary, that you know, which is a specialty pharma distribution company. We work all over the our sweet spot is more defined by what the company is than what industry they're in. Our sweet spot is a company that has $10 million revenue to $150, is privately owned, is either family or partner owned. We don't work for any institutional ownership. And they have either they decided to sell and they want to get ready, or they're stuck and they're not quite sure how to keep growing. Or they're growing, but they're not growing as fast as they could otherwise. That's our sweet spot more than an industry. And we say it can be in any industry. We've only aware of one company in 11 years that turned us down because we weren't an industry expert. So what we tell our clients and what seems to be true because we keep getting hired is we don't need to know. In fact, we think it's an advantage to not know your industry because we don't come in with any bias about this or that related to the industry. We keep an open mind to everything, and we decide, you know, the beauty of what we do, I'm not casting aspersion on investment banks, but the beauty of what we do is we don't have to arrive at a transaction to please our clients. We help you get to the right conclusion, whatever that is. All we care about is getting you to the right answer and let the chips fall where they may. Well, you know, most investment banks have a bias. They want a transaction because that's the way they make money. So this unbiasedness is what we sell, and it's the same in industry. We actually think it's better that we don't know your industry because we're not biased one way or the other about the good, bad, or the ugly in your particular industry. And as we go through that chart on strategic direction where there's the seven key areas of information that we're gathering as part of our check under the hood, we're open to the idea that industry could be a positive or a negative. So we're not, we actually think it's better that we're unbiased about your particular industry.
Which is really great. John, we've had a half dozen questions come in, so I'm going to summarize them.
Okay.
And they boil down to what should organizations expect to pay regarding fees if they're using an investment banking organization or some other organization, and then also a firm like yourself, how you're compensated for your services.
Sure. Investment banks is a wild card because it depends on size. The bigger the size, the smaller the percentage fee. Most of them work on percentage fees, and they work on retainers. You know, for a good company, you can get very little of any retainer, 25 or 50,000. In some cases, we've gotten zero. And as a total, by the way, Dana, for all the work we do, if you hire us to help you with a pre-transaction plan, typically we pay for our fee just in negotiating the investment banking letter. Forget all the other work we're going to be doing about having a well-prepared company, about having the numbers ready to go, about having confidence behind the story that we're selling to people. We save money we more than pay for ourselves in just negotiating investment banking letters. So having said that, typically there's some kind of retainer fee. Some banks, so here's the rub. The fewer banks that you talk to, the less good deal you're going to get because you don't know what your options are. You don't know what the spread is on some of the key points. So some investment banks like to get a retainer fee for every month. Some like to get it non-creditable towards a success fee. That's just unacceptable to us, both of those, get a fee every month. If they're getting a retainer fee every month, it's because they think the probability of close is low, and they want to get as much of fee as they can before they get to the magic moment of whether they can sell the company or not. Which, by the way, in this market takes about 6 to 7 months from start to finish when you hire a banker. In terms of percentage fees, most of them work off of percentage fees. So the bigger that the actual potential value is, the smaller the fee. The company that we just negotiated, I want to say, is an $80 million deal, and we're going to pay our banker. It's a graduated fee, so what we like to do is get a progressive fee. It's what we do is we take the average value from the three companies, the banks that we talk to, so we get a sense of what the market's telling us is average value. And then we take the bid from the bank that we want to work with the most, and we cut them. If it doesn't, all the banks typically get a proposal progressive fee. What we do is we cut their fee below the value, the average value, and we give them more than they ask for above the average value. So that if they do a below to average job, they get less than what they wanted. And if they do a great job, they get more than what they wanted, which our clients are all happy to help with. But the percentages run all over the board, so it's tough to say. I forget if I said this $80 million deal, I think that we're going to pay $1.2 million or $1.2.5 million. And it turned out in that case that the person we liked the best had the best fee arrangement as well. Others were higher. So that just gives you one data point. What was the other thing?
You covered it really nicely. I want to take one more question, then what we're going to do is we're going to open up the line so you can ask John directly.
Okay.
The question is, how much revenue do companies have to be marketable, and can they be under $5 million?
The answer is yes, they can be under $5 million. It's just $5 million companies with $500,000 or $1 million of EBITDA don't go for high multiples. That's the only – you can generally sell any business that's running, that's doing well and not in stress or decline. The question is how good a price you're going to get.
So that's what it all boils down to. Okay.
Yeah, in that case, size matters.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. On your screen – you'll see an area you can register for an upcoming August 18th open line program entitled Attracting, Motivating, and Retaining Top Performers. And you need to attract, motivate, and retain the top performers in order to get the top dollar for your business. So you should all be attending and invite your friends to this
there
program.
There you go.
If you're in an association or any roundtable groups, please feel free to have them sign up on our website for this program. It's going to be an amazing program. Larry Comp will be doing it, and he's just over the top amazing. Next couple days, you guys will be receiving a recording and a PowerPoint of today's program. Again, I'm going to open up the line in just 1 minute, but John and I want to thank everybody for being a part of this program. John, that was amazing. If you want to talk to John and have some one-to-one time further or just be offline, have a private conversation, you have John's contact information from the program itself on the screen. So, again, thank you for attending today. Let me shut off the recording feature, and we'll be right back, and I'll open up the line.